This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
And perhaps you will come back. And when you do, bring your friends, bring your wife.
I have no wives.
No wives at all? Oh, I have six. No, seven.
I've counted eight. And that is because he is traveling. At home, he has more.
Believe me, my friend, it is a great advantage of many wives.
Someday I hope to have one.
One wife? One God, that I can understand, but one wife that is not civilized. It is not generous.
From lusty sheiks to ruthless terrorists, Arabs have been vilified in Hollywood from the beginning of the silver screen. Our guest tonight has been studying Arab stereotypes for years, but after September 11th, these stereotypes take on a whole new significance. We're talking about Arabs and Arab Muslims in the movies. Joining us from Hilton Head, South Carolina, is Jack Shaheen. He's author of the new book, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. Hello, Jack Shaheen.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
We opened the hour with a cut from Ben-Hur. Jack Shaheen, tell us what we heard there and tell us something about how Arabs have been portrayed by Hollywood over really more than the last century.
Well, the early image of the Arab was really rather benign. He was the lusty sheikh who had too many wives, and he was always out to attack members of the foreign legion, or he was fighting fellow sheikhs in the desert. He was never a romantic figure. Valentino, of course, as most of us who are familiar with that film, mm-hmm. The Sheikh and the Son of the Sheikh, was really an Englishman in disguise. He was never an Arab, per se. Mm-hmm. So the myth of the romantic Arab is just that. It's a myth. But that image, Islam, was somewhat revered, and when the Arab was being stereotyped in the early days, so were Asians and so were blacks, anyone who was rather dark. You know, we mm-hmm. saw Africans in the jungle up against Tarzan. Asians were rather subhuman types. And so the Oriental image, along with the image of the black as the cultural other, those were prevalent in the silver screen. It wasn't until really after the 1940s, I would say beginning in the mid-60s after the 67 war, the Arab-Israeli war, that the image began to dramatically change, where all Arabs were portrayed as dastardly villains. And the images that we saw really taught us to hate the people of the region. We were taught to hate Arab Muslims in particular. And this is what's so interesting. There are 1.2 billion Muslims in the world. But the villain was always the Arab Muslim, never the Muslim from Iceland or from Russia mm-hmm. or from China, always the Arab Muslim. And that image, you know, the image of the sheikh, instead of just being in the desert, all of a sudden he was oily and he was much more sinister in his desire for women. He didn't want to enjoy women. He wanted to dominate them. He wanted to brutalize them. He was cruel. He was vicious. He was subsidizing terrorism throughout the region. He had always, like the early image of the sheikh, he wanted very much to seduce the blonde, fair-haired maiden. And then compounded to this, what we added were these horrific images of Palestinians as only terrorists. Only terrorists. We never really saw Palestinians as a people who were under occupation, who suffered. We never saw Palestinians being killed by Israelis. We never saw Israelis and Palestinians sharing commonalities. We never brought Arab and Jew together as a people that share so much in common, share a common destiny, a common humanity. Instead, the image taught us basically that the Palestinians were, like their predecessors, the oily Arab sheikhs, subhumans. And then to go on even further, Egyptians were portrayed as grave robbers, as babbling buffoons out in the desert, anti-American. And then we had all the other Arabs tossed in. We had the Lebanese, the Tunisians, the Algerians. They were all villains, the Libyans. And finally, Hollywood said, what about the Arab woman? And in the early days, we had really fine portraits of Cleopatra, you know, Claudette mm-hmm. Colbert as Cleopatra, Elizabeth Taylor, rather heroic women who had an identity, a personality. But The image again shifted, where they became bundles in black, standing in the corner like black dots without an identity, or bosomy belly dancers who were rather kinky and not necessarily attractive. Or they had, you know, jugs, water jugs on their head walking around. And then we add to that the image of Black Sunday, where they were portrayed as terrorists. So taken together, since 1896 mm-hmm. up through and including 2001, prior to 9/11, the tragedy of 9/11, most movies, most of the time, portrayed Arab Muslims as a people that we should detest. Not only us here in the United States, but everyone. You know, our films reach, 150 markets worldwide. And so, unfortunately, those are the images that we've been inundated with over the past 100 years.
It's an enormous legacy. Jack Shaheen has cataloged it in his new book, Real Bad Arabs, which goes through, it's more than 900 films, I guess, Jack.
And yes, that's why it took so long to finish.
You spent 20 years doing it. Jack Shaheen was a former CBS News consultant on Middle East affairs. He's author of Arab and Muslim Stereotyping in American Popular Culture, Nuclear War Films, and the award-winning TV Arab. But this new book that you've just come out with this year just goes film by film, pointing out the stereotypes and how they've evolved and have not evolved over the years. It's fascinating, among other things, you point out, Jack Shaheen, how other groups have played this kind of punching whipping boy over time and have graduated more or less out of that class, while Arabs haven't, and in particular how there was a time, especially in, Nazi-era films out of Germany, when Jews were cast in this role of the ugly other, the Semite, the utterly untrustable character in film after film. How ironic that should come to be what the Arabs are left with after all, when everyone else gets to graduate from that stereotyping exercise.
Well, I call it the new anti-Semitism. Not that it's new, and not that anti-Semitism is dead. It's not. There's this undercurrent in our society against Jews, unfortunately, that still exists. But the Arab image of today parallels the image of the Jew of yesteryear. The physical features are exactly the same. The only difference is the Arab wears a robe and headdress, whereas yesteryear's Jew used to wear a black robe and a yarmulke. But the Jew was out to control the world with his money, and he was out to seduce the blonde, fair-haired maiden, just as the Arab is today. And the Jew had a religion that was different than, of course, the Christian, than Christianity, just as Islam is different from Christianity. And so all of those similarities play a dominant role. Only now it's the Arab.
Jack Shaheen, we pointed out at the very top of the show just an awful situation you must have felt yourself in for some time. We all did. But after September 11th here, you know, you'd written a book decrying the kind of stereotype attributes of violence and terror. And then on September 11th, we have Arabs who commit this historic act of terrorism in the United States and in some grotesque way fulfill some of the Hollywood stereotypes. How have you been wrestling through this, you know, in your own mind? What awful timing at the very least. And then have you seen Americans being more open to breaking through stereotypes since the 11th or less?
Well, first, you know, 9/11 crushed each and every one of us.
Mm-hmm.
Every member of our family, just mentally, physically, like all families throughout this country and abroad, were emotionally distraught for weeks afterwards, mourning for those who perished and feeling great empathy for the families. I didn't think of my work at the time at all. I just blanked it out. And then weeks later, I began to really step back and try to be analytical. And I came up with the reality. And the reality is that those dastardly evil beings who killed so many innocent Americans represent the lunatic fringe, just as the movies before 9/11 represented the lunatic fringe. They do not represent 270 million Arabs, nor do they represent 1.2 billion Muslims. The problem is 9/11 not only gives credence to those stereotypes of the past, but it gives a green light to producers and writers to continue perpetuating the stereotype in the future. I think we should see movies, we absolutely must see movies, showing Arab Muslims as terrorists who did what they did to innocent Americans. And make no mistake about that. But I also feel, and this is as important, that we must begin to humanize the peoples of that region, that we can no longer afford, we don't have the luxury to afford vilifying an entire people just to make a few dollars or to advance a foreign policy that we think may in the long run work. History taught us that when Germans vilified Jews, that made the Holocaust more feasible.
Jack Beatty, I'm sorry, Jack.
I'm sorry. Just let me finish this thought that... Thank you. That we vilified for decades Asians in our films and in the newspapers, that made it possible to put into camps Japanese Americans because public opinion basically supported the government. There was no outcry. And finally, one of the reasons African Americans were denied their civil rights were the garbage of the film industry, the images of mammies and sambos and big black bucks that existed for decades. So one would hope that we would learn from the past and move forward to address some of the ills that we've committed vis-a-vis the Arab Muslim people of today. Mm.
Jack Shaheen, we've got Jack Beatty with us, our news analyst here. And Jack Beatty, I wonder if as you listen to Jack Shaheen describing this legacy of vilification of Arabs by Hollywood, have we in part created our own difficulties in reaching out and communicating with this community today? Jack Shaheen quotes Plato in his introduction saying, "Those who tell the stories also rule society." By painting Arabs as villains, have we made the outreach that we clearly need at some level now all the more difficult?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that that probably some of the rash of hate crimes that broke out around September 11th had in some ways these films as deep background. I mean, we're all, as it were, affected or polluted by them, and I think that on the other side, of course, it's where there's a whole vilification industry in the Arab world of and some government subsidized institutions of Americans and of Jews and of, you know, revival of the protocols of the Elders of Zion and so on. So you have, as I think you said in your introduction, you have stereotypes on both sides. But what's really frightening about ours is this is part of our entertainment industry, and that many of the things that Mr. Shaheen, many of the movies he deals with, the Arab villain or the Arab butt is gratuitous. It's just an add-on. It's not organic to the. If you're doing a movie about Israel, you're going to have to deal with Palestinian terrorists. If you're doing a movie about a California couple that's selling their house, you don't have to bring in an Arab caricature. And yet that sort of thing has happened again and again. For some reason, Hollywood can't get the Arab.
Jack Beatty, stand by. Let's listen to a little bit of that Father of the Bride Part 2. I think you're referring to.
Yeah.
We need house a week from Wednesday, and my wife wants flower dishes in kitchen. You sell, we pay top dollar.
For the house, top dollar?
Would $15,000 be generous enough? One, two, 3,000 flower.
Hang on, guys.
You have a problem, George.
Mr. Habib, you didn't tell me you were going to tear down the house.
You didn't ask.
Sell the house back to me. I still have your check here in my wallet. I never even cashed it.
I don't think so, George. See, I demolished house, built two in its place. This is a great piece of land.
Sell me back my home.
For how much?
You want to make a profit on something you own for one day?
Yes.
There's the heartless Arab dealmaker talking with the character played by Steve Martin in Father of the Bride Part 2. Jack Beatty says, why in a funny movie out of a California suburbia does the Arab come off as the heartless villain? We're talking this hour with Jack Shaheen, author of Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
You
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
The U.S. military presence abroad was rocked today when a bomb exploded in the army barracks
in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia.
Ripped the front off the 8-story military dorm, exposing just how vulnerable U.S. troops are here. In
Marines on duty seem, for the most part, numbed by the horror of the morning.
Early indications suggest this to be the work of Sheikh Ahmed bin Talal, a radical fundamentalist cleric known to have issued a...
The explosion appears to be the work of terrorists. And if that is the case, like all Americans, I am outraged by it.
Soundtrack from the 1998 action blockbuster The Siege, which sparked huge protests from Arab Muslims in America for stereotyping Arabs in the film as part of a network of terrorists. We're talking about all stereotypes of Arabs in film this hour with Jack Shaheen, author of Real Bad Arabs, that's double E real, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. And with our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. What do you think? Are you offended by Hollywood caricatures of Arabs? Are you prepared to stand up and protest those caricatures after September 11th? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Shaheen, walk us through. We heard just before the break a clip from Father of the Bride Part 2, the Steve Martin film, and now after this clip or sounds from The Siege, what do these two clips tell us, and how do they fit into the pattern of Arab stereotyping that you describe in your book?
Well, I wanted to make a comment, first of all, to what Jack Beatty had to say, concerning the propaganda that comes out of Arab countries and also
voluminous propaganda.
Yeah, well, but it does not exist in the Arab cinema, not at all. We are not vilified in the Arab cinema.
Is that right? That's amazing.
Yeah, never, never. And
there's so much in the newspapers.
Yes, in the newspapers, editorial cartoons, both sides play that game, and it doesn't serve anyone's interests. And what saddens me is that, Jack, that the vast majority of Palestinians and Israelis are peace-loving people. And now and then I'd like to see some films that show that reality. And unfortunately, that reality is absent. And they need it as much as we do, I think, to understand that there's more in common, than that they have much, much more in common. With Father of the Bride Part 2, I couldn't watch it initially. I mean, we know the Father of the Bride movies. There was never such an Arab-American character, never in the early, Spencer Tracy, Elizabeth Taylor movie. Mm-hmm. And what troubled me about that film in particular, and what troubles me about The Siege, and it is tied in directly with what's happening today. In the history of Hollywood, there have only been 18 Arab-American characters in movies that could be identified as Arab-Americans. And the vast majority of those characters, in 14 of the 18 films, those characters resemble the Arab-Muslim stereotype. In other words, we are, Americans of Arab heritage, are portrayed pretty much the same way the Arab-Muslim caricatures are on the silver screen.
So immigration, assimilation is not allowed.
Assimilation is not allowed. The fact that we've, been here for nearly 200 years and, 75% of Arab Americans are Christians and we're well integrated and the vast majority of us don't have accents. Yeah. And we're more American than apple pie. I mean, maybe put on the ice cream and that's the exact identification. But those images are denied American, indeed world audiences, so that we are somehow, at least on silver screens, the negative Arab stereotype, which is Arab equal Muslim equal terrorist, is being transmitted to American of Arab heritage equal Muslim equal terrorist. And that frightens me.
Jack Shaheen, here's,
and concerns me.
Here's another clip from The Siege that speaks to that, a Palestinian-American professor.
His name is Samir Najdi, teaches Arab studies at Brooklyn College. He's the one who sponsored Ali Waziri's student visa. And dig this. His brother blew up a movie theater in Tel Aviv.
Well, you can play him like a cop and haul him in now and get your arrest, or you can tag him and let him lead you to the really big fish.
You're fishing and he's getting visas for bombers.
You ever heard of catch and release?
Mm-hmm.
sound from The Siege. Why do you think Arabs have become open targets for Hollywood stereotyping? What are the consequences in America and abroad of our Hollywood stereotypes? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, Jack Shaheen points out that Arabs are not exactly even permitted to immigrate and become Americans in Hollywood's perspective.
Yeah, it's like some ineffaceable taint of the other that they carry. And, you know, you can say, well, all right, there's been terrorism in the world since the 1960s, or at least this modern round of terrorism. A good deal of it has come from the Arab world for reasons having to do with the politics of that region. So Hollywood has, there's a certain historical background that would give resonance to a depiction or even an allusion to terrorists in a movie. In other words, I don't think we have to go to the stereotype to think terrorists. There's been a good deal of terrorism, and we know that. What's troubling is that the stereotype is so much deeper than just the terrorist. It also has a racialist feeling to it as I'm listening to these clips. And if it were done with any other ethnic group, say it were done with Jews, say it were done with Chinese, say it were done with African Americans, it would not be acceptable. The only thing I can compare it to really is the systematic defamation of Italian Americans in movies.
In the old mafia films.
Well, and then in the Godfather films. And the new mafia films.
Yeah, well, Jack, excuse me, I tell my friend Guido I'll trade images anytime. It's not that we shouldn't have movies showing Arab Muslims as terrorists. Absolutely. I mean, this is a reality, and we need to see films such as these. The problem is those are the only images. Hmm. What don't we see? Do we ever see an Arab Muslim? And pause and let's think for a moment. I mean, you're asking such great questions, but have we ever seen a film with an Arab Muslim that had a wife and children that did what other people did?
You tell us. You've looked at them all, Jack.
Absolutely not. We fail to – the only way a stereotype can be successful – the only way you can vilify a people is to dehumanize them, and that's what the industry has done. The industry will not allow us to see Arabs as next door neighbors.
Is this
and
because
that's the problem?
Is this because we simply need someone to put in the villain role, and so Arabs have had the misfortune of falling into it, that Hollywood needs easily communicated bad guys? Or why is it that Arabs have fallen so deeply into this groove and are not being permitted out of it?
I don't need to feel good by picking on someone else, and I don't think producers need that either. I think there are several major reasons, the dominant being the Arab-Israeli conflict, economics. These movies make a ton of money, and certainly a lack of presence in the industry. There are no Americans of Arab heritage or no American Muslims who are, in effect, creating these images. They're being created by others who know little or absolutely nothing about the region or about the peoples of the region.
We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's invite them in. We're talking about the depiction of Arabs in American movies. Hollywood's depiction of Arabs. Jack Sheehan has written a new book called Real Bad Arabs. That's double E real. How Hollywood vilifies a people. Why do you think Arabs have become open targets for Hollywood stereotyping? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Sean is calling from Providence. Hi.
Hello?
Sean. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're good. Thanks.
The reason I called actually is that I had tuned in earlier, and Jack, I only caught bit of your last segment where you played a clip from, I believe...
We had The Siege and The Father of the Bride 2.
Right, The Father of the Bride, but I think The Siege as well. And Jack, I think you're making a very important point, and I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, I think this is sort of... in America right now, this sort of sensitivity where I don't know where you draw the line and say, at one point, is this just a character in a film and not offensive? And at one point, I mean, what if the character had been who is playing that, exaggerated villain who's trying to resell the house to Steve Martin were played by a Chinese American or a or a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant or an Italian-American.
Sean, your phone's cutting out on us a little bit, but I think we've got your question, and let me put it to Jack Shaheen. Sean is saying, well, hey, someone's got to be the doofus villain. Why not the Arab character?
Well, I think I've always been a tremendous advocate of sharing. You know, we just celebrated Thanksgiving, and everyone brings a dish, so we should spread it around. The danger is not that we can't, we stereotype Italians. I mean, we have the Sopranos, but look at all the wonderful Italians that we see in films. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, warm-hearted, good mm-hmm. people. I mean, it's simply a matter of being balanced, and my argument has been and continues to be, and I really pray that I'll live long enough to see this, that we portray Arab Muslims like we portray anyone else, no better, no worse. And when that day happens, I can stop writing about stereotypes.
I'm sure you'd be glad to do that. Jack Shaheen, hold on. Let's go back and listen to a clip from Casablanca. It's not only recent films that have this going on. Casablanca.
Can't you make it just a little more, please?
Sorry, madame, but diamonds are a drug on the market. Everybody sells diamonds. There are diamonds everywhere. 2,400.
All right.
You will not find a treasure like this in all Morocco, mademoiselle. Only 700 francs.
You're being cheated.
Doesn't matter, thank you.
Ah, the lady's a friend of Rick's. For friends of Rick's, we have a small discount. Did I say 700 francs? You can have it for 200.
I'm sorry, I was in no condition to receive you when you called on me last night.
Doesn't matter.
Now, for special friends of Rick's, we have a special discount of 100 francs.
A special discount half a century ago in Casablanca, and the Moroccan vendor is trying to cheat poor Ingrid Bergman. Jack Shaheen, I guess it never lets up. That goes way. That goes way back.
No, the souk or the marketplace swindler image, again, parallels the image of the Jew. Always, you know, he's shady, he's sneaky, he is always out to cheat you and to take your money, which, of course, anyone who has been to the Middle East knows that bargaining is a way of life. It's a fun process. You never go in and simply take the first price. Merchants love to bargain with you. And once you befriend a merchant, once that happens, it lasts forever, for as long as you're in that region. But unfortunately, the bungling or the shifty souk swindler image began in the early 1900s and is with us still today. I wonder what impact it has on Arab banking, particularly Arab banks in New York. I'm sure that image, I mean, would you put your money in an Arab bank? And if so, why? And if not, why not? And go back to the movies.
Jack Shaheen, let's turn to our callers again for a moment. We've got Steve on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I just have a really ordinary comment to make. I have over the past year met a lot of Arab friends through my Arab girlfriend, and I think the thing that struck me most as an American is just how, you know, the ordinary background. I think a lot of Americans have an expectation that, you know, people are the same the world over, and this was really my experience with this group, and I think it's a very prosaic, ordinary thing to say, but I think, especially in these times, it's important to point that out.
Steve, thanks for calling. It sounds like you've got the firsthand experience there. And let's bring another caller in. There a lot here. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
We're well, thanks.
Listen, I start out with a very basic comment. Sometimes truth is what creates those movie images as well. I appreciate, Jack, what you're doing here, and I think it comes at a very appropriate time where we need to be unifying people. I just wanted to point out a personal experience of mine, though, living overseas for a while in France, which has a unique relationship with Algeria, I'm sure you understand.
And a bitter history.
Quite. And so perhaps the story is a bit tainted, but my experience with Arabs in France was a very difficult one. I know people that were hurt very badly in many different ways on many different occasions by groups of young Arab men.
So you're saying that the stereotypes are deserved?
I'm saying that there's certainly some basis in reality.
Tom, thanks for your call. Here, Jack Shaheen, we have back-to-back a call from Steve who's saying his girlfriend is Arab and he's over the last year met a lot of Arabs that are good friends and not like the movies, and Tom, who's ready to step up and say, hey, there's more than a grain of truth here.
Well, I can only say to you, Tom, I worked for our government in Germany for 3 years. Mm-hmm. I worked in a place called Kaiserslautern, a small border town called Fulda and West Berlin. And I returned to the United States. I was asked, what did I think of the Germans? And my response was, which ones? Because I encountered many different Germans, some of whom were, you know, I could almost say clones of what had taken place during World War II. Others who were pretty much like you and me, and the third group, which were just outstanding, marvelous, wonderful individuals. Every group has its disgraceful fringe, and if we focus only on that disgraceful fringe, we do ourselves and the people a disservice.
Let's listen to one more clip before our next break. Here's some sound from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, 1966.
That's all right for you. You can go around like a hogged-up Arab, slashing at everything in sight, scarring up half the world if you want to, but let somebody else try it. Oh, no.
Clip from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? You can go on like a pumped-up Arab, slashing at everything in sight. Jack Shaheen?
Well, those one-liners and scenes that have absolutely nothing to do with Arabs or the Arab world or the region pop up in more than 250 movies. I was astonished. I mean, why? Why do you have a wonderful film like Chapter 2 by Neil Simon that begins with the brother asking his brother who's just returned from London, how was London? Full of Arabs, you know. Mm. Or another Neil Simon movie, Mecca is a smelly place. And these one-liners just keep popping up. It's like a virus. I mean, what troubles me about Hollywood is that I perceive producers as doctors who recognize the virus but who are reluctant to do anything to stop it from spreading. And I think that's the situation that we have now.
Jack Beatty, can you see how Jack Shaheen must feel kind of overwhelmed? It just keeps coming.
It does. And, you know, I've had an aesthetic experience in recent years watching Iranian films. Admittedly, they're not Arabs, but it's the Muslim people. And suddenly, watching A Taste of Cherries, I was reaching past all the stereotypes, and I was seeing human beings, people I could go up to and with whom I could sympathize. And I thought, my God, this hasn't happened to me in the cinema in a long time with people from this region. And so we have to almost go... That we almost have to go to those films to find the humanity that's hidden from us in our own films.
The humanity that we may need to find right now to heal the rift between the United States and parts of the Arab world. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back after a short break. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with author Jack Shaheen about his new book, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, and the long history of Arab stereotyping in American movies. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Here's a question for you. Is peace with the Middle East in general more difficult because of our Hollywood stereotypes? What are the consequences in America and abroad of these stereotypes perpetuated by Hollywood? Jack Beatty and Jack Shaheen, let me put that to you. Jack Shaheen, first, what are the consequences of this over time?
Well, American films are popular everywhere, particularly in the Arab world, and you continually show to particularly the younger people, and you continually show young Arab men and women the same images that you show women, that they don't exist, that they're submissive, that they are ignorant, and that they belong, you know, really in a corner all by themselves. You keep showing that image over and over and over and over again. Perhaps that woman begins to think she is that way. You show an Arab, a young Arab man, that he is a terrorist, that he throws bombs, that he hates Jews, that he hates Christians, that he hates Americans, that he hates everything, and that his religion advocates violence. And you show him those images over and over and over again, constantly repeated, time and time again. What is he going to think, not only of himself, not only of the mirror image that he sees on the silver screen, but of the individuals and the nation that is exporting those images to his and her country.
Jack Beatty, what about it? Is there the risk or the fact here of a kind of self-fulfilling characterization?
Oh, gosh. I mean, just to hear that, of young people seeing these stereotypes and then acting them out. The cultural industry has a lot to answer for. I mean, similar statements have been made about African-American young men who are given these vile stereotypes in rap music that they then, you know, as if this is a possible life for them, as if this is the only possible life. And we all just sort of benignly say, well, a good book never hurt, or a book never hurt a good girl. Well, some books have, and some movies have. And we don't even have a language in this country to talk about this because of our First Amendment feelings. And I really think we need one. I mean, there, some people talk about a cultural pollution movement on the order of the environmental pollution movement, a way to fight back against these people through product boycotts, through other things. And maybe that's what needs to be done to sort of tell it, to hit Hollywood where Hollywood hurts, which is the pocketbook.
But Jack Beatty, step way, way back with us and look at September 11th for a moment. Is there any sense in which this intersects with the awful events of that day? Is there a way in which somehow mass media shut down the conversation between regions and peoples of the world, or help shut it down in a way that leads to explosions?
I don't know. I have no answer for that. I mean, this, the dynamics of this are so far beyond anything that culture can instance. It is interesting, though, that one of the complaints that Bin Laden, and not that he need, his complaints need to be taken seriously, but one of the complaints that Bin Laden-ists make is that our culture is a corrupting, corrosive, undermining force, and that we're not responsible for it. It's trying to undo the cultures of other countries, and that Bin Ladenism and Islamicism generally is a way of fighting back. That's a frightening picture of American culture, too.
Jack Shaheen, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Hal is on the line. Welcome, Hal.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I saw in the news the widespread images of celebration across Palestine on the evening of September 11th, and I wonder if you dismiss that as a lunatic fringe.
Well, first of all, that was not that was a woman with some children, and that was selectively framed. If you go beyond that constantly repeated clip and you go online, you'll find that there were literally thousands of Palestinians who were mourning as to what happened in New York, literally thousands. But we were denied those pictures. We did not see those pictures. I had to go online to find them. That was a reality of a gross distortion as to how most Palestinians felt about what happened on 9/11. And let me just go on record to say that.
But you can feel in Hal's call the bitterness and
yes,
anger.
Because that's what he's exposed to, and I don't blame him. These images are selectively framed and repeated over and over and over again with one specific message in mind: hate the Arab Muslim. Now, the evidence is there. It's in selected newscasts, and it's in motion pictures, and it's repeated again and again and again. And until it stops, we are unfortunately going to perceive not the perpetrators of this horrible crime as the lunatic fringe, but as the entire region. And that's the danger. When we begin to perceive 1.2 billion people as the enemy, as seen one, seen them all, they're all alike, they're all terrorists, all of them. Hate them all. Kill them all. When that happens, then we lose our perspective and we hurt ourselves. And we cannot afford to let that take place.
Jack Shaheen, let's turn to the calls again. Terry is on the line. Welcome, Terry. You're on the air. Hello, Terry. Are you there, Terry? I think we've missed Terry. Let's listen to one more clip. Jack Shaheen, this is from your list of the very worst of stereotyping films. And again, as with Father of the Bride Part 2, it's a film that we think of as a frivolous, fun-filled family film. This is a scene that many listeners may remember from Back to the Future.
This is heavy duty, Doc. This is great. Does it run like on regular unleaded gasoline?
Unfortunately, no. It requires something with a little more kick. Plutonium!
Doc, you don't just walk into a store and buy plutonium. Did you rip that off?
Of course! From a group of Libyan nationalists. They wanted me to build them a bomb. So I took their plutonium and in turn gave them a shiny bomb casing full of used pinball machine parts. Come on! Let's get you a radiation suit. Jesus. We must prepare to reload.
Crazy Arabs on the trail of a nuclear bomb in Back to the Future. Jack Shaheen, why does that one make your worst of list?
Well, you know, it's Steven Spielberg. I mean, Here's a man who's very sensitive. Here's a brilliant filmmaker. The Arabs have nothing to do with Back to the Future. Why inject Arab terrorists in Back to the Future? The scene was a gross distortion. It broke the continuity of the film. It had no place being in the film. It was just tossed in. Spielberg does it again in a movie called Young Sherlock Holmes, where, believe it or not, Moriarty, Holmes's nemesis, turns out to be half Egyptian. And he does it in his Indiana Jones film. So when you have mainstream filmmakers, great humanists like Spielberg vilifying Arabs, where do we go?
Yeah,
I mean, because these are the leaders of the industry.
It's pretty tough. Jack Shaheen, thank you for joining us this hour.
Oh, I want to thank you and Jack for your insights, for allowing me to try and bring us together. Because the more we embrace tolerance, I think, the better chance we have to bring peace to the world, and that's what we want.
Hear, hear. Jack Shaheen is author of Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. Jack Beatty, 30 seconds. Final thoughts?
Well, I think we've seen a frightening and sort of disgusting picture. But maybe that can change. I mean, President Bush sent an emissary to Hollywood who was talking to people about how to make movies. I think Mr. Shaheen met with him as well. This kind of thing may have a good result. I don't know. But we've had a bad record here, and something needs to be done. And an industry that has sort of gone out of its way to do this really has to change its ways, because there's a lot at stake now.
There sure is. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and read Jack Shaheen's best of and worst of lists of films that depict Arabs on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. We're taking a time out tonight for one of our occasional readings of your postings at the Special Coverage website. Our conversation last night with Robert Fisk and his sharply negative assessment of the war in Afghanistan brought a flood of responses. Several agreed with Mr. Fisk, but others vehemently did not.
Fisk claims that the U.S. caused the troubles in Afghanistan, and part of the cause was our pulling out soon after the war with the Russians. After that war, one would think there would have been great national pride and unity among Afghans. But they were so heavily armed, and it was so easy for tribes to fight for power, and the most powerful group was the one led by Osama bin Laden. I feel like we'd led the horse to water and it wouldn't drink. Something about Afghanistan seems to make it a non-developing nation.
What gets me is how the U.S. gets blamed for the aftermath of the war with the Russians. We helped this country win the war and have since given them many millions of dollars. Were we supposed to stay in there forever and somehow compel this country to form a democratic government?
Last Tuesday, we spoke with Barry Posen about the ethics of handling trapped terrorists in war and asked what we should do with Taliban fighters who surrendered in the besieged Afghan city of Kunduz. Your postings on our website gave solutions across the board.
The old rules of how to treat prisoners of war are not so applicable. Those rules apply to a certain level of gentlemanly conduct, and the behavior of the Taliban and their supporters towards the Northern Alliance, and vice versa, are certainly not gentlemanly. There's so much passion involved that the survivors and their children will harbor ill feelings forever. Both sides know this, and the only cure seems to be death. From our perspective in the USA, do we want the survivors to go back to Pakistan or wherever and regroup and attack us again?
I think a distinction needs to be drawn between the rank-and-file Taliban and Al-Qaeda here. Taliban militia seem to me to be due the treatment accorded under the normal rules of war. After all, we accorded the Nazis these rights and privileges, and they committed far worse crimes. Al-Qaeda, however, seems to me to have totally forfeited any rights under the rules of war, since they do not abide by the rules themselves. I say the choice should properly be unconditional surrender or death, period. If the Taliban chooses to stay and fight alongside Al-Qaeda, then as Phil Graham said, if you ride with thieves, you die with thieves.
And on our Longview series, many of you wrote in about our energy policy installment, sharing many of your own concerns and solutions.
One thing we should all start noticing is that the oil companies know that the end of the fossil fuel age is near. They are aware of their contributions to global warming as well as decreased oil reserves. If you look closely, you will see they are positioning themselves for the next energy revolution. They say they are energy companies, no longer oil companies. BP has invested in solar, Enron in solar and wind. The energy revolution is slowly taking place. What we need to do is accelerate it.
Our best alternative for the future seems to be the hybrid electric gas systems. This takes advantage of the current infrastructure of gas stations and the delivery systems now in place, but cuts the use of oil. I've even read about fuel cells that can use gasoline. Now, if we can just increase our domestic oil production as we lower our usage, we could become energy independent or close to it. We need to drill in Anwar and everywhere offshore that we can to accomplish this, and we need to do it soon.
The implicit question has been, can we power our current style of living with alternative fuels and energy sources once the oil runs out? Perhaps it's time to take another look at our lifestyle, especially as regards transportation. We've spent a century reorganizing our land use so people live as far as possible from where they work and then commute daily between the two, consuming vast amounts of energy and generating vast amounts of pollution in the process. Maybe we should take a step back and ask ourselves if there is a more rational way.
Thoughts from our listeners in the online forums at www.wbur.org special coverage forums. Jack Beatty, what do you think? There's a huge range of opinions right there. How about nationally? Do you see the national dialogue, the national conversation about the war spreading out, getting richer?
Yeah, and I think about our guests that we really should make our callers into guests. Just listening to those to those responses,
bring them on.
You know, bring them on, because I think one of the things that happens on radio, television is we all sort of say what we learned in college. We all come across as very sound, very reasonable, and a lot of the vitality of thinking goes by the boards, and you know, there's a kind of unbuttoned quality to an eclectic quality to thought that you get from just John Q. Public, who isn't trying to sound serious on the radio.
Don't I sound sober and clued into the one and only way?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I love the diversity there, and our calls bring it to the show every night as well. They're not just giving a party line.
That's right, and it just brings home to us that the political debate is much broader, and the range of alternatives is much broader than what we get in the sort of, if you will, mainstream media. It isn't just one thing and the other. There is also the other, and then the other. And we keep hearing this from our callers, who keep saying, "Well, wait a minute, let's change the terms of reference here and see how the problem looks."